introduce the speaker and, for this evening. I know a lot of you are...
Before I introduce the speaker for this evening, I know a lot of you are know John personally, and like maybe as I have. But, you know, John was giving me a little jab there tonight at the supper table. He was saying, you know, you didn't think you'd be sitting here tonight having dinner with me in his high-class restaurant and going to be up there chairing my meeting. The night you went home and told your wife that you were ashamed to talk to me because I was an Indian and I was telling other people what we lived like on the reservation. And that was the truth. I tell you, I was a phony. And geez, you know, to go along with my booze problem, I guess that goes with it hand in hand. But geez, I went to this big meeting in this little town near where we used to live in Massachusetts. And I came home and that night and I told my wife, I said, Jane, guess what? I seen an Indian tonight. She said, you did? Where? What's his name? Did you talk to him or did you tell him who you were? Not me. I said, I ain't telling that Indian what I ain't telling that Indian or letting anybody know that I know that Indian. Because I don't want people to know that kind of Indian I am. I said, geez, you know, I want everybody to believe that I was a different kind of Indian. You know, high class, you know. Whatever you read about in a newspaper that, or a book that that gave you an impression that an Indian was great. You know, high steel worker. That's like the night I was running a bingo at our church. And this lady come in and she says to me, I would like a taxi. She said, I'm really not up to playing this game. So I said, okay, I'll call you a taxi lady. So I call her a taxi. Well, before the taxi got there, we got into nationalities and so on like this and work. And I got around to tell her I was a construction worker. And I said, Indian. She says, you are. She said, you must be one of those brave men that go way up on this high steel and work. And I said, no, lady, that's another tribe. I says, I belong to the chicken tribe. I get dizzy when I look out the window. But without taking any more of John's time, I would really like to introduce my friend and your friend, John.
Thank you, Ben. I'm John, and I'm an alcoholic. And good to be here. I, too, was in my own reservation last week, working on the alcohol and drug abuse program. And I was thinking how, while I was sitting there, how my life has changed. And sometimes, you know, it's like a dream that... I guess I'm the last person in the world would have ever believed that one day I could get up in front of a few hundred people and be grateful about it. Where I got sober in Syracuse, New York, it was an understanding that if you were sober 3 months, you were supposed to get up and speak. Well, I said to myself, you would never get me up there. And I remember when I got sober 3 months, I walked into a meeting late. And at this meeting, they used to have big post, and I used to sit in the back. And every meeting I go to, I would go late. Because I've always felt so sensitive that I never talk with English, and I had no education. And somehow I developed some kind of imaginary idea that those who get up here had some kind of a special talent in choosing the right words. I guess how it happened, my first speaker in AA was a lady judge. Here I am, I'm 28 years old. I have been skits for 7 years, and... I'm now living in a mission. That's where I was when someone came to see me one night, another bum who got sober in Salvation Army. He walked into a mission one night, and he says to me, "I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Good for you." "I have never met one before." "I came here," he said, "to ask you if you want to go to a meeting." I said, "No." "Because the only meetings I've gone to, this fella by the name of Tom who run the rescue mission, if you attended one of his religious services, he would always allow you to sleep on a dormitory with other bums. So I have attended a few of Tom's religious services. But tonight I had a bed." Well, this fella said at this meeting, they have coffee and donuts and they're free. Well, I said, "Why didn't you say so in the first place?" Here I am, I'm 28 years old, and I'm not dressed too well. I needed a haircut, and I suffered from wine sores. And I needed to be sober about 6 weeks so that my face would clear up. And I, you know, I've never been married, never owned a car, I couldn't read and write, and I'm in a mission. I'm supposed to pay 35 cents a night, and I'm behind 3 weeks' rent. You know, I have financial problems. And I'm listening to this lady judge. And she's telling story about her father being a judge. Her husband is a doctor and a director to a general hospital. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, as soon as I get my donuts, I'm getting the hell out of here. But this, you know, they say that God works through people. This man who stood at the door when I came to AA was a lawyer, sober 13 years, and his job was to shake hands to the people who were coming to that meeting. And of course, when he seen me, he grabbed my hand, and then he said that he was happy to see me. And I don't know if I was happy to see him at all. But on my way out, he probably knew, like most of us know later on, that I couldn't see myself with the lady judge, that I felt I didn't belong there. Whatever it was, he put his arms around me, and he says to me, "Before you leave, I want you to meet some of my friends." And probably the most amazing thing about this whole business of coming to AA, I have not since then wanted to drink. And whatever magic that we do have here, which I myself don't understand, whatever it was that brought me back to the streets for those 7 years was removed from me. And about the only thing that was removed from me. And I came back because I liked the way his friends treated me. I liked people who I thought they really cared about me. And it touched me. And of course, coming back, it's where it's been, where I have been fortunate, because I needed to learn things about me that I didn't know anything about. One was that I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. When they talked about first drink, somehow I understood, because I have always known that once I took a drink, I never could stop. What I didn't know was that there were people somewheres were staying sober a long time, and I have never known that. Because alcoholism to me was something like very private. And when I'm not drinking, it's very difficult for me to, because I listen to speakers. I have been listening to speakers for 32 years. And everybody get up since the day I came to AA, I can identify, because I the same way. When I'm sober, I remember my first speaker was that I understood was a fellow by the name of Harry J., who was a secretary in Central Group. And Sundays, he would invite me to his home. His wife, Helen, and he had two daughters. And he would bring me back to admission. And Harry spoke one night, and Harry talked about something I have known all my life, and that is loneliness. You know, but I thought loneliness was reserved only to a bum. Maybe someone who have no education, or maybe an Indian never fit in life. I never thought Harry, who is an officer in a bank, who has a nice home, a wife Helen, and two daughters, would talk about things that I felt laying on the floor in a mission with 40 other bums. Now, I don't think I understood really what Harry was saying, but what I felt was, for the first time in my life sober, that I wasn't alone. Because my illness somehow told me, every time I stop drinking, John, there is nobody like you. Absolutely nobody. And you're no good. You know, Judge said that. Judge told me that Fayette Park in Syracuse was for the decent people. And I agreed with him. And I want you to know that there is no worse kind of a sickness than when you say, yes, I am no good. You know, there's difference if someone said it. And I really believed that I was no good. But you see, my problem, and where I have been fortunate, that I needed to learn how to live. And in Syracuse, New York, every meeting you go to, they would read the fifth chapter. And fifth chapter, you know, talks about the program of recovery. But there were no step meetings, and I couldn't read and write, and I didn't know what they were talking about. So here I am in my 50th sobriety. I'm now 33 years old. I'm working on Salvation Army on a truck for $16 a week. And I have a pass in my pocket telling me that I could come home at 11 o'clock. And life is tough. You know, because, you know, first 2 years in AA, it was good. It was good because I was meeting new people. We're going out after the meeting and have lunches and helping people. But slowly but surely, the things that I felt alone when I walked in the streets came back. I was lonely walking in the streets. I was bored in AA meetings. I felt, I go to a meeting and people say, "Oh, you do, John?" I got to say yes, because when you're sober 5 years, you're not supposed to be lonely. And you're not supposed to feel scared. You're supposed to be like other people who get up and they talk about buying a new car, going to school and getting divorced and married again, and divorced and married again. At least they're doing something. So I did what I've always done when I feel this way. I guess, even looking back now, I had to learn how to be honest with myself and with my feelings. And because I didn't have a program, the program says the key that opens the door to a program of recovery is in believing. And believing is the only thing that it will start to make you honest and accept the truth about who you are. And there is no principle is effective unless the truth is behind it. But how do you tell anyone, "I'm sober 5 years and I'm lonely and I'm scared," when you're not supposed to be by this time? Well, I did what I've always did, and what most of us do, I suppose. When we feel we don't belong, I left Syracuse, New York. Broke. I didn't know where I was going, and I really didn't care. And I arrived in Marlboro, Mass. at 1:30 at night. town that I have never been before. And in the main street, there is a flop house called Hotel. And I stayed there. And next night, I went to the Saturday night meeting, and I met a fella by the name of Paul, who owned the restaurant. He says to me, "John, they're starting a new group in Worcester Monday night. Would you like to go?" I said, "Sure." So I walked into my first step meeting. And what they did in Worcester, and still doing it today, was to read the first few pages of the step. And then they would separate themselves to 12 in each table, and then everyone would start to express their ideas, their insights, their beliefs as to what this particular step means to them. And there, at the age of 33, I've heard for the first time what our co-founder talked about, what we read tonight. Steps are a recovery. But I didn't understand it. I've never heard these words before, and I didn't like it. I mean, I didn't say it to myself, "Gee, I find something, I can't wait till I come back." I said, "I don't like this meeting." You know? And I go back, and they were talking about that I should be restored to sanity. I didn't like that at all. I've been around long enough by this time that I felt the sum should be restored, but I wasn't one of them. So I wouldn't go back. I would go, Paul would say to me, "Would you like to go to Worcester?" I would go, and I remember sitting there one night, and Bill Wilson said, "All alcoholics, that means me. All alcoholics," he says, "are self-centered and extreme." I said, "That's not fair." I'm just a poor Indian who never had a chance. You know, and it's not fair. Here you are, you don't have a home, you don't have a job, you don't have a girl, you don't have an education, you're lonely, and you go for a meeting for help, and someone calls your names. I go back to my open meetings, because in open meetings, if I say, "Well, you know, I don't have a home," don't worry about it. Just go to meetings and don't drink. I like that because I didn't like work. "I don't have a car." Don't worry about it. Just go to meetings and don't drink. And if I tell someone, "You know, I need a girl, I'm horny." Don't worry about it. Just go to meetings and don't drink. Now they said I'm self-centered in extreme. I mean, 33 years. I was able to blame everything to everybody. Now they point a finger at me. And I don't understand it, and I don't like it, and I wouldn't go back. But you know, they say that God works through people, and sometimes in a very strange way, because of all the people in the world, you would imagine that one day a priest and I would get together. You know? Just like you would never imagine that this bum with long hair and wine sores and dirty, one day a lawyer put his arms around him. I mean, the world just don't live like that, you know? I mean, I've never met people like that. I met Father Fred. He's now 80 years old, so over 30 years. "John," he says to me, I go to institutions, and I was wondering if you come with me. I need someone to travel with me." I said, "Sure." I said, "But don't ask me to speak, because I don't talk in English, and I don't have an education." Well, he said, "Don't worry about it." And I thought that meant no. It was very intelligent to me. And so we travel. We go to different institutions, and Father Fred is a good speaker. He's got words, and he's, you know, and one of the prisons we went to was in Walpole Prison, which is a maximum prison, killers. And one Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock, Father Fred get up, and he says to these killers, I brought a speaker with me. And I knew there was nobody else there. I looked around anyway. Now, what do you say to killers? I mean, I'm just a Skid Row bum, and I had a terrible time to make 59 cents for a quarter of a wine. I mean, I'm not a killer. I don't even consider killing anyone. Oh, there were times, and I'm sure you felt the same way in my younger days when, you know, when I drank, I had this feeling that I could lick anyone. And that's a very dangerous feeling. In Syracuse, New York, there is a bar room they call Smitty's. That's where all the New York Indians drink. I'm a Mi'kmaq Indian. I don't drink in Smitty's. Because Mi'kmaqs and New York Indians don't communicate too well. But when I feel good sometimes, like licking someone, I go to Smitty's. And I would drink there, and I looked around, and I'll find someone who looks like I didn't like. And I would stare at him for a long time. Make him weak, you know. That's what animals do. Make him weak. Then I would go over there, and I would say to him, you know, you look like somebody I don't like. And I would hit him. And they would call the cops. And I have never had trouble with cops. I used to wish I could put one of them down, but they always sent two or three of them. Because that's where New York Indians drink. That's why they sent two or three cops. They didn't send them because of me. But one day they send this big fat cop all by himself, and I figure I'd take care of him. And boy, him and I was wrestling, and I got a very good hold on his pants, and I pulled. But he's so fat that his pants came first. And next morning, he brought him to the courtroom. And he stands there holding his pants like this. Judge said, John, he calls me John because I've been there before. He says, what's the problem? I said, nothing. All I want to do is put him down. But he's so fat. And Judge Dorsey was an alkie. I didn't know him. So he started to laugh. And people in the courtroom started to laugh, so I laughed too. Until I got 3 months, they were all still laughing when I... But you don't stand up in Walpole Prison and tell these killers how you tear cops' pants. But I suppose I'm the last person in the world, whatever I said when I get up. Who knows? Who knows? If someone came to me that day and said, John, you hang in there, and one day you received a call from Munton. You know, I have a sister who lives in reservation in Maria, Quebec. She comes over and visit us, my wife and I, and our kids in the summertime. Last summer, she was telling me how well off we were when my father was alive. And that was news to me because I don't remember that. And she said that my father, of course, made a living in making moccasins by the dozen to a lumber company, and axe handles and baskets and snowshoes, and he would trade everything. And my sister said that in our house we had one room full with food. And my sister's idea of being wealthy is to have one room full with food. And thank God she still believes that. But I'm not from, what do you call, a dysfunctional home. Everybody today comes from a dysfunctional home. I tell the kids down home that the only reason you come from a dysfunctional home is because you're in it. And, but I'm from a troubled home. And my family took sick after my father died, and they all died with TB. 7 of them, including my twin brothers. And I think when we talk about fears and not being able to share them, I can look back after my mother died at the age of 13, and she died with TB. I developed what I call today a very unhealthy feeling that I was not wanted because most people felt I had TB. Now, this is, of course, not true, except it was true to me. And that is a part of my illness, that I must come to learn to see the truth one day. You know, because Bill Wilson said, we will not wish to shut the door in our past, nor the past will ever deprive us from the spirit of being free or being effective as human beings. But it was real to me. You know, I live in this old empty house with a dog in between two mattresses for almost a year. And I had fears because fears cripples my life. I couldn't sleep. That's where fear affects me. It makes me feel insecure. It makes me feel scared. And that's the way I felt. And I guess there is nothing wrong to feel that way. The problem is when you don't share it. And it seems to me that even when I lived in skids, you know, I have never met a bum and said to me, John, this morning I'm lonely. Or this morning I'm afraid. Or this morning I need love. We seem to have problem with those human things about us. You know, and I didn't know that. I left home because I felt I wasn't wanted. I was a little over 14 years old when I arrived in Patton, Maine, in CC camp. And I met the fella by the name of Bill Langster, who is in charge. And I was with him for 4 years washing dishes. And when I was 18, I left the lumber camp. I wanted to go back home to my people, but I thought the war was on. And I thought that if I could join the army and if I get a pass, I could go home. So I went to Quebec City and joined the Canadian infantry, not because I'm not a patriotic type of person. You know, I knew then that this country was ours before it was yours. I figured it was your problem and not mine. I was hoping maybe I can win a medal without getting hurt, because I'm a very sensitive person and I get hurt easily and I don't suffer well. What I didn't know was that if you don't have an education in Canadian Army, they wouldn't allow you to go on training. So I wound up washing dishes. Now, this is the problem where problem starts for a person like me. The book talks about a man without faith. It's a person who cannot live with himself. We cannot, because faith represents the truth. And one who does not have faith will seek approval. He will tell lies about himself just to fit in. Don't you know, nobody can fit in with a lie, no matter how good you are. Because it's not people that removes you. It is you who remove yourself. You know? They say when you don't have faith, you will settle for less. All people without faith settle for less. Without faith, you never make a decision based on whatever experience or knowledge that you have. But you based it on fear. You know, I look back when I was 18 years old. Here I am. I want to be something, you know. I don't know why, but I want to go home to my people with a uniform on so they can say, Jesus, he's grown. He's something. But something happened. When I washed dishes, he told me that I was nothing. That's what he told me. And I wouldn't go home. And I wouldn't go out with the girls who might say, what do you do in the service? you know. And I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke. And I find a friend who is from Ontario. His name is Joe, and if he's not in AA, he should be. But we didn't drink together. We're sick in hell. We always talk about doing great things. One day, someone said to us that in St. Lawrence Street in Montreal, if you go over there with money, you can pick the girls right in the street. You don't have to worry about rejection. They don't have to like you. All you need is money. And that was good news for Joe and I. We talk about it for about 6 months. One day we'll do that. And one day we went and we found the girls. We stood there. And we stood there longer than most girls did. I didn't know I needed a drink. I just felt what people would say if I do such thing. Never mind what I say. Anyway, we got our discharge together, and he says to me, what do you say we each buy a suit? We did, and we went to, those of you who ever drank in Montreal, we went to Bloery Cafe in the second floor, and they had a four-peat orchestra playing as you walk in, and this beautiful girl standing there singing practically with no clothes on. And I think that's where I received my first spiritual awakening. And then I took a drink. And you know the story about drinking. I don't know if I drank because I felt uncomfortable being an Indian, or because I washed dishes in the Canadian Army, or because I couldn't talk with English. I don't believe that. Because, you know, I've been sober 32 years, and I have met a lot of sick people. I mean, I met some people that are really screwed up, and some of them poor bastards don't even know enough to drink. I mean, if trouble make you an alcoholic, there would be an alcoholic, you know? Maybe the lady judge was right. I never understood a lady judge. She used to say that it's a mental obsession that precedes the first drink, and once you take a drink, now it's coupled with a physical compulsion. And I used to say, holy Christ. I wished if I had her disease or something like that. The book talks about an alcoholic suffers from the obsession of mind. Maybe that it is true. Maybe when I walked in there 32 years ago, somebody somewhere just picked her right out to me. With all the troubles I had, and I had fears I might get drunk, but I never once wanted to drink. All the troubles I had since then, never, never once, I thought it would be a good idea for me to go out and get drunk. You know? And didn't happen to me alone. I mean, we're now in 120 countries. There is some magic that lives here, you know, and it's here. And this is what happened to me. And the second thing the book talks about, that I am a type of person, that once I take a drink, I experience a physical abnormal reaction that non-social drinkers don't. And what it means to me, I suppose, that all the years that I have been coming here, and everything that I have learned, and everything that I have, and friends, that if I was to take a drink, all that stuff you have taught me wouldn't do me a damn bit of good. And you know that. You see people who go back, you know. But what keeps me sober is this getting down on your knuckles and asking, you know. And it kept me sober long before I believed or knew anything about it. But I didn't, because I was simply told, you know. Now, get back to drinking. I love to drink. Every once in a while, you know, somebody will get up there and say, you know, I never had a good time drinking. Well, you know, the poor bastard, you got to feel sorry for him. 30 years he drank, and he never had a good time. And I look at him now, and I say, you're not doing so well sober. Like Father Martin says, if you're happy, you forgot to tell your face. I like to get close to people. There is some magic about drinking that I could put his arms around someone and say, you know, I like you. I like the idea of falling in love about twice a month. 11 o'clock at night, I'm looking at her with one eye, because no longer can I see her with two, and telling her how beautiful she is. And she is, because alcohol affects your vision. And next morning, you look at her, and you say, holy Christ, you were so cute last night. I can't wait to get drunk again to fall in love. Now, that to me makes sense. And I loved it. And when I was going through that, you don't come to me and say, John, you're drinking too much. Hey, I'm enjoying myself. You know, some speakers said, the reason I didn't like when I drinking, I woke up with people that I didn't want to be with. That's why I drank. To be with that type of people. I enjoy drinking. But all at once, something happened to us. And you know, they say you have to be ready. And I tried it. In my days, there were no treatment centers. So every once in a while, a bum would say to me, John, you look sick. Why don't you take a pledge? And you know, when a bum tells you you look sick, you're sick. So I would see a priest, and supposed to be a Catholic, and I would go to confession, because that's what he wanted me to do. And the message was, of course, trying to be a decent person. And I know how to be decent. I really do. I was brought up to be taught what is right and wrong. The problem was with me, after a week or 2 weeks of being decent, I'm so lonely, you know? And I don't know where that came from. I was lonely when I wasn't decent, you know? And I felt I didn't fit in, you know? I couldn't sleep. I have all these fears. I felt different. And you know, nothing changed. And then I would get drunk, and I said to myself, yeah, you're no damn good. Then Tom would say to me in a mission, there's a fellow by the name of Billy Graham, coming to the War Memorial. He said, this man helps a lot of people. You go and listen to him. So I go to War Memorial for a couple of weeks, and I listened to Billy Graham, and I got sober, but he left. And I got drunk. And he's very confusing. It really is. I remember I was in a mission one night, and this fella get up. He said he was a bum just like us. He said, right in this mission, he said he accepted Christ as his personal savior. And since then, he said, he never drank. He got married. He bought a home. He worked nights. And he said he has a new station wagon. And then he says to us, any of you bums can do the same thing. All you have to do is move forward. So I move forward, and I know nothing about Christ. You know, I spent 4 years in lumber camp, and I used to listen to those lumberjacks talking about him. You know, and by the time they finished with him, you wouldn't believe him either. But here I am, I kneel down, and he kneeled next to me. He said, I was saved. And next morning, the judge says that the Fayette Park is for the decent people. So what happens to Father Fred? I said to him, because I've been over this step meeting, and they're talking about being restored to sanity, and it hurt me. I said to Father Fred, what do you think about this business of being restored to sanity? Oh, he said, John, you don't think you understand the step. I said, what? He said, step says you come to believe. I said, Father, I've done that. You never worked for me. He said, you did what? I said, I went to confession. I listened to Billy Graham. I accepted Christ. And every damn time, I wound up with a judge. You know, he has one track mind. And I said, look, I'm sick, not stupid. I don't get mixed up with that. He said, that's not what the step says either. I said, well, how do you believe? Father Fred says, in the book, he says, all you need is an open mind. That's how everybody believes. You open your mind to become teachable. You know, do you know the self-centered person is a person who does not have an open mind? Do you know what our co-founder says? The chief activator of all our problems comes from a self-centered fear. Do you know the self-centered person, a person who cannot have a relationship? Terrible, terrible time with relationship, because it's not a person who gives anything. It's not a person who willing to understand anything. It's not a person willing to accept anything. It's a person who wants something. Who wants something. I'm not like that. I'm not like that. You know, he misunderstands me. I'm a nice person. I just never learned how to fit in. You know, and if I had a nice girl, someone that I really love, not just any girl, because I had any girl before, it didn't help. Someone that I really care, nice home, good job, money in the car, then maybe I wouldn't feel that way inside. What is it that Bill Wilson talks about an alcoholic? How we rationalize it, how we justify. He says that through the years, he has developed layers and layers and layers of self-justification. You know what that means to me at the age of 33, John? Your problem is because you're not an Indian. Your problem is it's not because you're an Indian. It has nothing to do whether you can talk good English or not. It has nothing to do whether you have an education or not. It's not because you're an Indian. It has nothing to do whether you can talk good English or not. It has nothing to do whether you have an education or not. Your problem is, I am not teachable. You know, I protect that by rationalizing and justifying. And you know, when you talk about a spiritual awakening, the spiritual awakening represents a new state of consciousness. You learn to see something that by yourself you could have never seen. New state of consciousness. The book calls it a gift. A gift. You know? And on my way home from the bus to Marlboro, 16 miles, I said this for the first time in my life. John, you're 33 years old. You don't have a home. You've never been married. You don't have an education. You don't have a wife. You don't have a car. Father Fred said, we all have to start from where we are with what we have. And you know what I said? I think I will. Didn't know what the hell I was going to do, but I was going to do something. Guess what happened? Every morning I go to the restaurant. Paul owns the restaurant. I walked in there this morning, and Paul says to me, Rita, who was the waitress, she wanted to know if you could paint her house. I said, sure. I used to paint steeples in the church when I was drunk. He says to me, she wants an estimate. Why don't you go over there and give her an estimate? So I went over to see Rita. It's a big house. It's a funeral home now. I went in there, walked around three times. I went in there and I said, Rita, it'll cost you $300. She gave me a job right away because other contractors wanted $1,200 to $1,400. Just because you're trying doesn't mean you make sense. Yeah, I got a job. I said to Paul, I have a job, but I'm broke. Why don't you go back, he said, and ask her, give you some money. She gave me $100. I got me a little room, kitchenette, for $7 a week. I went over to buy me white coveralls. I figured if I'm going to be a president in my own company, I should buy me a white coveralls. I went to a meeting that night, and the fella came to me, and he says to me, John, I'm told you're looking for a ladder. I said, yes. He said, I work for a telephone company. I will deliver you a ladder Monday morning, but don't tell anyone it's against the rules. The damn thing is yellow. You know, you can see it miles away. But I painted this house, when I finished, I owed Paul $65. And I was in the hole. I was at the meeting one night, and this plumber came to me. He says to me, I'm told you're painting houses. I said, I do. He said, I have a little ranch house 7 miles from here. All you need is a stepladder. So I borrowed a stepladder and got all my drop cloths together, and I stood in the corner, and I stopped a buzz. And the guy looks at my ladder, and he looks at me, and he says, "You're not serious." I said, "I am. I'm self-employed." And he says to me, "If I give you a ride, would you promise you'll never do it again?" But my next house was a school teacher. Paul says to me, "John, there's 69 questions. Why don't you ask her to help you?" And she keep telling me that she taught school 40 years and she retired. So one day I said to her, I said, "You know, I don't have an education, and I like to get my driving license, and I wonder if you could help me." She said, "John, I've taught thousands of people, and no time at all, I knew the questions inside out. Even I knew I was going to pass." And I went in the Marlboro police station, and this guy brought me in this little room, and he only asked me two questions. I mean, I got depressed. I said, "What the hell is the use to have an education? Nobody gives a damn." But he gave me this pink slip. I had a license, and Paul came to see me where I was working. He brought a big black station wagon. I used to call it 11 passengers because I used to bring 11 people to a meeting. "John," he said, "for $750, it's yours." But I had no money. The lady who belonged to Marlboro Group, she says to me, "John, if you can borrow $250, I will co-sign for you." And next morning, I borrowed $250 where I was working. She co-signed for me, and here I was in my 50-year sobriety. I was president in my own company. I had a driving license and 11-passenger station wagon. So I decided maybe I should find me a girlfriend. But I had these 4 teeth missing. I lost those while I was communicating with those New York Indians. I felt you couldn't find a type of a girl I was looking for with 4 teeth missing. But someone said there's a new dentist in AA. And by this time I've learned new people are very anxious to help you. So I went over to see him one night, and I said to him, "You know, I'm having some problems." "What's the problem?" he says. "Well," I said, "I'm looking for a girl, but I had these 4 teeth missing." So he gave me his card, and a couple of months later, he gave me a new set of teeth. Then I met a lady in AA. She says to me, "John, I'm told you have a car." I said, "11 passengers." She said, I run a home of alcoholic women. I have 9 girls, and I'm looking for someone to bring these girls to a meeting. Would you like the job?" I said, "I'll be very happy to." That's where I met my wife, Kathy. On our way home that night, I said to her, "Would you like to go out on a date?" She said, "No." I mean, she didn't even think. And I'm a very sensitive person, and I get hurt easily, and I don't suffer well. But on my way home, I said to myself, "Who in the hell she thinks she is? Here she is living with those women. None of them have anything. And here I am, I'm president in my own company. I drive 11-passenger station wagon, and I have a new set of teeth. Who the hell wants her anyway?" But next Thursday night came along, and I picked the girls again, and on our way back, I said to her, "Would you like to go to a show in Boston?" And she said, "Yes." And on our way back, I asked her to marry me. That's 27 years ago. 6 children later. And that's the story. Kathy and I get married, and we brought up 6 children. 3 boys. We got twin boys. 3 boys and 3 girls. And my wife, she's sober 27 years now. And, you know, of course, Wouldn't it be nice if I can say that one day this Indian without an education, without trade, without nothing went over there and he just made it? That's not the way life is. You know, God don't come down and say, John, let me make a decision for you. That's why the third step says we make a decision. But I must say, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because where can you find people? All you have to do is ask. I mean, we got everybody here. I mean, you name it, and we got education here, we got lawyers here, you name it. All you have to do is ask, and people will be very glad to sit down and talk to you. You know, and growing up, you can't do it alone. I remember when Kathy and I were married, we had our first baby, and I went to IGA and tried to cash a $15 check, and the guy wouldn't cash it, and I insulted him. And he says to everybody, this is your third check bounced in this store, and they're never going to bounce again. And I'm telling you something, I don't know about you, but it hurt me. But there was a man at Wellesley on Tuesday night. It's a gentleman retired from work, and he always smoked a pipe, you know, very quiet. And I used to talk to him. I went over there, and I told him that he wouldn't cash my $15 check, and I need to buy groceries. I'm behind on a car payment. I'm behind on oil. I got a wife and a baby. And he just stands there and listens to me with his pipe. That after he finished, he put his arms around me, and he said, John, but you're doing so good. You know, it was news to me. Just a year ago, he says, you didn't have a woman that loved you. Can't you see? Keep saying that. Just a year ago, he says, you didn't have a baby, John. Just a year ago, he says, you didn't have a room. Just a year ago, he said, you didn't have a car. John, can't you see? You know? But this man was talking about values. He was talking about things that don't mean nothing to me. Because I don't know how to live. You know? I don't know what spiritual life is all about. You know, in closing, to be honest about you, so much of what I am today, I will bring engraved with me. And thank God that I have learned that it has never been the lack of what I am that has ever robbed me from the spirit of living. But it has always been the lack of acceptance of who I am. It never allowed me to go from where I am with what I have in life. I have never can accept, John, you are what you are. Stop denying yourself. Stop putting yourself down. Stop saying that you're not good enough. You are what you are, and you're going to be until the day you die. You know? But what can I do? First, you learn to accept who you are. Stop fighting who you are. Happiness is not when you become somebody else. Happiness is not when you got that job or that money. Happiness is not when you get your degree. Happiness comes from the truth, and truth is who you are. That's what you're denying, John. That's why the step says, go home and sit down and put in the paper about you, everything about you that you can remember. And when you finish, find someone and tell the truth about you. Tell the truth. And if you do that, he says, then you will experience some freedom from isolation. And when you finish, you go the next step and say, God, there's nothing you can do about you, but you can say, God, I'm ready. The third step doesn't say you're going to do something. The sixth step, he says, you become ready. And the next step, which is the seventh step, you humbly ask him. And when you ask God for something, you have to accept his answer. So you got a lot of problems, right? You got a lot of pain, and you got this, and you got that, and you go up to God, and you say, oh, God, remove it, and God don't. So you said to yourself, you didn't hear me. I'm going to ask him again. And we're creating an emotional conflict. What we don't want to accept, that God says pain is a touchstone to a spiritual progress. If I remove your pain, you're not going nowhere. Trust me, he says. Trust me. That's the secret. And if you trust God, you learn to accept yourself. When you stop fighting yourself, you learn to start being effective. After all, in closing, in 11th step, a prayer of St. Francis, our co-founder says, the only reason we have chosen St. Francis, not because he's a saint, those of you who read the 11th step, you know he said that. He said, we have chosen him because in his lifetime, he was crazy as we were. So you have a chance to pick up a saint. Don't look at me. I know I'm not going to make it. You don't know my record. What St. Francis said. St. Francis didn't say anything that you and I can't say. What St. Francis did was to exercise the gift that God gave him. I have right to choose. St. Francis said, I choose, Lord, that I want to be an instrument of thy will. He didn't say, I want to be perfect. I want to be good. He said, I want to be instrument. Because whatever you and I become in life, we become by choosing. And then he said things like crazy. He says a lot of crazy things. Lord, he says, where there is hate, I may bring love. Not if you're self-centered. Where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Where there is doubt, where there is darkness, I may bring light. And then he says things that really way out of reach. Like, Lord, he says, I pray that I may understand rather than to be understood. Lord, I pray that I may love rather than to seek love. That I may console rather than to be consoled. Then he says, for it is in self-forgetting that you find, and it is in giving that you receive. And we sometimes said to ourselves, is this too much? Or is it what St. Francis said is reserved only to human beings, that God gave them right to choose? And all St. Francis was saying, God, today I'm choosing. That's all he was saying. You know? Can I say that? Sure, I can say it. I might not believe it, but I can say it. It's been a pleasure to be here. I talk about my wife quite often, and our children are growing up now. My wife is working to support me. And Kathy, would you stand up and say hello? Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. That was terrific. Now, can you see my situation back there trying to identify with somebody like that, a high-class Indian like me? Especially now, it would have been all right if I knew that 25 years or 26 years later, he would have a 14-room house and two automobiles and a construction contractor. I would have been able to identify that. But, Doug S., would you thank the speaker, please? Okay, Donna's going to do it. Sorry?
Hi, everyone. I'm Don Took. I'm an alcoholic, and this is a surprise for me. It may not be a surprise to John, but it is to me. By the way, John, I could stand a little painting around the house. This has been a real pleasure for me. I was in a position just for a short period to try to be of a little bit of help to contact a few people, and John was coming, and I knew that his sidekick here, you know, that they come from a long way back. So the real treat for me was the night that I called Ben and asked him if he would come up and chair the meeting for John. And you should have heard him on the other end of the phone. I really couldn't do it because I don't feel that young. But it was a real pleasure. John, I don't know. I just can't say too much. I think I know how people feel. I got so much out of what you've said. I've heard you many times. And tonight is just more special. I don't know. I guess maybe it's the first Atlantic and being part of it. I just hope everybody has a terrific weekend, and I know you're going to have it anyway. There's no point in me wishing it on anybody because it's here. This roundup has been a success since our first meeting, and it's just looking better and better. And give me a hug, will you?
Side two is finished.